This is Focus, our morning talk show. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Information technology now makes it possible for any doctor at any hospital to have complete access to an individual's full medical history. And that certainly could give that doctor a life-saving advantage, but it also opens the way for massive violations of privacy. In this hour, Focus, we'll be looking at a major research effort that involves the University of Illinois and other universities, an effort aimed at improving the security of electronic medical records. Our guest is Carl Gunter. He's professor of computer science here at the University of Illinois. And as we talk about the issue, questions are certainly welcome. We just ask people to try to be brief, but we certainly invite anyone to call in if you have questions, comments. The numbers here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. And toll-free, 800-222-9455. If you would like, you may also send your question or comment by email, and that address is will-talk@illinois.edu. So at any point here, if you have questions, comments, you're certainly welcome to join us. And thank you very much for being
here. Good morning.
We get into this this research effort that the university is involved in some depth, and in the issue is in some depth. But just as a way of starting out, in one or two sentences, in a couple of sentences, if someone said, "Well, really, what does it mean to me as an individual health consumer that we are making this move towards more and more of people's medical history being stored and accessed in electronic form?"
Yeah, it has at least two significant benefits. One is for primary use. That is, if I go to see the doctor, they can have my entire record available to them or as parts of it that I approve them having available to them at the point that they're providing my care so they can be well informed. It's particularly important in cases like an emergency room where there may be a lot of information that is pertinent that could be readily available. And also the computer systems can help the doctors so that we're getting increasingly large amounts of complex information, and that has to be presented to both the doctor and the patient in a way they can understand. And so computers can help take much more sophisticated information and make it understandable. Another benefit is that as we get more and more of the information on computers, it can be access for purposes like research so that procedures can be analyzed as to whether they worked or not. We can use that information to improve care over time.
Yeah, and certainly you can see the advantage, not just the advantage of if you were going to your primary care doctor, of that person being able to do a couple of keystrokes and get your medical history. But if you would happen to be, say you're on vacation, you get sick, you have to go to the hospital, maybe you're incapacitated, you can't speak. Well, the doctor is treating you, then the theory is that then also with a couple of keystrokes, that person should be able to get your medical history, know what your pre-existing conditions are, know what you might be allergic to, know everything that they would need to know to treat you when you would be in a position where you couldn't give them that information.
Yes, and there are examples of where health information exchange systems in cities have been used in those ways where they feel confident that they've saved lives as a result.
Yeah. So then just again, so we can go back and talk some more about some of these things, but let me turn it around and have you talk a little bit about the security challenges here.
Yes. So one of the implications of this is that if the information moves quickly and freely between places where you might need it, there's the pathways that move that information could be abused, and that information might move to places that you don't approve of. Mm-hmm. And so there's a trade-off here, which is if the data is going to be easy to get for the people who need it, you have to make sure it's not easy to get for the people who might abuse it.
Yeah. So now this we're definitely moving in this direction more and more, and certainly over now two presidential administrations, the federal government has been encouraging healthcare providers to move in this direction, even offering incentives for them to move in this direction. So clearly that's where we're going. And clearly there are security concerns. So now we have this major research effort sponsored by the federal government involving a number of universities, including University of Illinois, in looking at these issues. And this is the thing that's known by the acronym SHARPS. So tell us about that.
Yeah, so SHARP is an effort that was put in place by Health and Human Services. It's called the Strategic Health Advance Research Projects. And it's intended to take the development of electronic health records, which has been incentivized by things like tax breaks, and make sure that it actually counts for something. So if you're going to incentivize people to put these systems in place, you want to be sure they do something useful. And so the concern was that we needed more technology that can exploit in a positive way these developments. So they set up a collection of these in what they considered to be four major areas where they thought this kind of help was needed. Of course, the security and privacy area is the one that we work on and we'll talk about in more detail, I guess, mm-hmm. today. Mm-hmm. The other projects are interesting to mention, though, because they cover very interesting topics, too. For example, the University of Texas at Houston has a project on making technology usable. That is, when the doctor looks at the screen and what he sees there, is it going to mislead him? Is he going to be able to handle it? When patients get access to their data, are they going to be able to understand what they're seeing and act on it properly? Mayo Clinic has a project on secondary use of data. That is, how do we handle the collection of the data for purposes of research? And Harvard has a project, a SHARP project, on platforms for health applications so that as we find new ways of doing analysis of health records, we can get those deployed quickly. There's also an affiliate project at Mass General, which works on interoperability of devices so that devices that are used in health can talk to one another safely.
Hmm. Well, I wanted to go back and talk. Maybe you can say something about the rate of progress moving towards getting people's medical histories in an electronic form so that such a thing could even be possible. And I do believe that the Bush administration set a goal of 2014 and said they would like to see by that time most people having their records in electronic form. And I think over the last few years, the percentage of doctors and hospitals that are doing this has gone up significantly. But it's not even half, I think, at this point. Where exactly do we stand with this?
Well, one of the challenges here is that many of the biggest health systems, like, say, Northwestern Memorial Hospital, would have an EHR system. But a lot of smaller doctors will find it inconvenient to change the way they do things and move to electronic records. And so they have to see good motives for doing that. And that's a gradual process for something like that to change the procedures that you use to do things. It's a challenge. So there's a combination of business issues and technology issues. My interests are primarily in the technology issues. For example, one might imagine that if you could use cloud computing to do electronic health records, then maybe that would make things easier because you didn't have to maintain systems in your own office. You could have someone else maintain the systems. But then that has obvious security and privacy considerations as you've effectively outsourced, you know, the maintenance of your records. Mm-hmm. And so that's why security and privacy are a big barrier here, that if we can address those issues adequately, then it will help us move forward with some of the benefits.
Yeah. And obviously, when you do this, move to electronic medical records, that's going to mean spending money, obviously. It also, we are told that in the long run, it's going to save money. But I suppose that part of the problem is that, well, yeah, the savings may come later, but the expenses of putting in new systems, that's going to be an upfront expense.
Yeah. So it has to be viewed as an investment. So over time, one will see the benefits as we get better at it and as it's got more. I mean, we have, of course, an importance of the more widespread the deployment is, the more it benefits. Because, for example, if you want your records to be available in one place when they were entered in another place, if they're in paper, then it will be harder to move them. And so as you get a greater deployment, you'll get greater benefit.
Our guest in this hour of Focus is Carl Gunter. He's professor of computer science at the University of Illinois, and he is involved in this project, this big research project we've been talking a little bit about. A number of universities are involved in different aspects of this project, of looking at the move towards electronic health records. And his particular concern and the concern of the folks here at the University of Illinois are about security. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. There, I think we already know that there have been security breaches of health data. In fact, I think I read, for example, a recent survey or study done by Health and Human Services said that personal medical data for more than 11 million people had been improperly exposed, and that was just in the last 2 years. And it's happened pretty much across the country. It's not just individual places. I think it was like 46 states or something like that. This had happened. So we certainly know that it has happened, and this kind of thing is on the increase, frequency going up.
Mm-hmm. Right? So there are at least two kinds of things we want to address here. There's best practices, that is, getting people to do the things that we know they ought to do. Mm-hmm. And so that if you're going to, say, dispose of medical records, you don't leave them on a trash heap on the street. Actually, many of the exposures are of this kind, and that they take the records and they're not encrypted and they're placed in an insecure location. And so that's it doesn't necessarily mean that there was a harm, but there was a threat that there could have been a harm. The other thing is trying to move the systems forward with technology advances that will make the risks smaller. So, for example, if you leave a laptop behind on a train and it has a lot of data on it, then if the data is encrypted, then you'll have a lesser risk from that. So you wouldn't want to do it in the first place, but if it's done, the harm will be limited by proper use of technology. The project we have is to look at these technology mechanisms that reduce risk and what are the barriers to getting them more effectively deployed.
I guess that raises the question, if you look at the security breaches that have occurred that we know about, is that primarily the result, you would say, the result of simple carelessness, things like the person who leaves their laptop on the train, or was that the result of a deliberate intentional hacking by somebody, people who are interested in stealing that data for whatever reason?
It's variable. So a lot of the cases are ones of inadvertent disclosures. Mm-hmm. But you see also a number of cases where it's snooping. So you have a health employees that have access to these records, and they don't restrain themselves when they're looking at the records, for example, of a celebrity. It's one of these insider threat challenges where, you know, if you have a lot of people having a lot of access, then you're going to get a rotten apple every now and then. And so that, you know, one of our challenges here is that there are people who are not doing anything very malicious, but where they're doing the wrong thing because they're not involved in the patient's care and they're just curious. And so that's another class of examples like this. But a little more serious is that you have whole classes of when you look at medical records, they contain a lot of information that could be used, for example, for identity theft. Mm-hmm. So you may have quite a lot of information there about the person, and that information could be used to pretend to be them in a lot of context. So one kind of thing is to take out credit cards in the names of the people in question because you have enough information to succeed in doing that. A more serious class of threat that's emerged is medical identity theft, where parties might pretend to be you in order to seek medical care. And this is a pretty dangerous threat that could spoil your medical record if you had it abused in that way.
Yeah, I think that's really fascinating. I would not even have imagined such a thing. I can understand. I think you could understand where somebody might want to mine health records to see if they could find things like credit card numbers, social security numbers, those sorts of things, because that for identity thieves, that's really very valuable. But the idea that somebody would get that information about me and then go down to the hospital and say, I'm David Inge and I need a heart transplant and here's my insurance information and let's go, and to have that happen. Well, apparently that actually did happen.
Yeah, there was a notable case in California where someone managed to get a heart transplant by pretending to be someone insured and got it covered on their insurance. So the possibility here is you might, say, get an insider who would collect the information and then could sell the information to parties who could then use it to pretend to be people that they can get the health care from that. You also get instances where people can do fraudulent billing of insurers, for example, Medicare, if they can get enough information to pretend to make fraudulent claims.
Mm-hmm. What sort of issues do you get into? I know that there are increasing issues because I'm sure people who work in hospitals and doctors particularly, they are using more and more mobile devices. I'm sure they're using smartphones, they're using tablets, they're using all sorts of things like that. That can, I'm sure, be great tools. But there can be, for anybody, there can be security issues involved in those things as well.
Yeah, that's an intriguing area of growth here. There's two sides to it. There's the doctor or employee-facing usages, and then there are the patient-facing usages. Mm-hmm. So, for example, a doctor may find it nice to use his cell phone to exchange some information as he is he or she is doing a task and in the hospital. But these devices are not necessarily secured for enterprise use. And so as the health records perhaps get into personal devices, then you might have some security threats from that, as you see an increasing threat for the security of mobile devices. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, individuals will increasingly do things like use cell phones in conjunction with other devices that they have that monitor their health. And so there will also eventually be threats to personal use of health devices that talk to mobiles.
Yeah, I think that I read somewhere that actually if that someone, and I believe that this was research that was done by a major internet security company, the people who are in that sort of business, actually went around and they did a survey and asked doctors, well, on your computers, the one that you use for work, do you have antivirus software? Are you using firewalls? And a surprising number of them actually said no. You know, the basic sorts of things that anyone using a computer or anyone going on the internet is advised to do. It seems like significant numbers of doctors are actually saying, well, no, actually, we're not doing that.
Well, the big practices, hospitals typically have security personnel who are responsible for setting up those sorts of systems. And they're able to do basic best practices that way. All the systems I've seen of those kinds have basic best practices. Smaller providers will have less access to professional staff and may be more challenged by the introduction of those techniques. It's unfortunate that doctors would be burdened with such a tedious task as figuring out how to secure their network. And so, you know, one hope is that those techniques can become more readily deployable with less expertise and time from the people who are doing them. Mm-hmm. But there are challenges here even for the big parties. So, for example, even a big hospital worries about questions like what happens as their doctors are bringing tablets in and putting information on them, and are those secured in the same way as the rest of the system? And also about things like cloud computing. So, you know, if a party comes to me and offers to host my system and it would save me a lot of money to do that, is that a safe thing for me to do?
Well, I suppose that does get us, maybe this is a little bit different issue, but that does get us into the issue of security for handheld wireless devices that more and more people are using. That's a big hole right now. I think it's true that really even if you wanted to have some sort of security for your smartphone or your tablet, I didn't think that there actually was anything.
Well, they have security protections there, but one of the challenges in this case is that you can put in technical protections, but sometimes that's not everything you need. Mm-hmm. So, for example, it's reputed that a lot of instances of Angry Birds contain various kinds of viruses and malware. Mm-hmm. And so if you deliberately install on your system something that has a bad origin, then there's a limit to what can be done to protect you from that kind of decision.
Yeah, so you ought to be only install applications and software from trusted sources, in as much as that you can do that.
Right, yeah.
Let me just very quickly mention again, our guest for this hour of Focus is Carl Gunter. He's professor of computer science at University of Illinois. And we're talking about electronic health records, something that we're moving more and more to. And there are good reasons why we're doing that, and they do it have some advantages, but there also are real security concerns, and that is something that he and his colleagues here at the University of Illinois are involved in, a major project that's being funded by the federal government to look at this particular question, that is security of electronic health records. Questions are certainly welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. And if you would like to send us an email, of course, you can do that as well. That's will-talk@illinois.edu. It will be in the future. I'm not sure if it is possible now, but certainly it will be in the future that people will have electronic access to their own records. And you would think that, in fact, now people should have access to their own records, but it may not always be easy to get at that. So this would be, in fact, it would be a very easy way to get at that. But then I suppose there's this question that, well, what do you tell people in terms of, we talked about best practices for a healthcare institution. Well, what do you tell an individual our best practices for themselves in dealing with their own records?
One of the great emerging benefits from electronic health records is the potential for people to become more directly involved in their own care. And so, for example, if you could go to a web page and see your health records, then you might be able to do things like correct an error that you find there. Mm-hmm. And you might be able to take information from your health record and use it to better seek advice, so that you could use that information to help you find things that would help you with the issues that you have. So the federal government has it's now required that you be allowed to get access to your records, and that they be available to you electronically. And the health care community has been eager to support people's deeper involvement in their care through the availability of these records. But of course, you know, you suffer the same kind of threats here as we've been talking about. Is if you start to download your information, then there is a threat that information could be compromised if you don't take care with it. So there are techniques for dealing with this. There are big providers that have secure solutions that will help you download your information, and they'll keep it for you. Mm-hmm. And then you can have an understanding with them, ideally, that the information is used in ways that you would consent to. You have the possibility of viewing it, you know, remotely. But I think that an important thing here is that you should take advantage of this, and that at the same time, you need to take care and take advice on the proper ways of allowing yourself to see that data.
Yeah. I'm sure that the conversion from paper to electronic form is an enormous task, particularly if you're a large institution and you have a lot of patients, which is going to mean that person or persons have spent, no doubt, hours and hours and hours going through the paper records and putting them into electronic form. Has anybody actually looked at just the simple question of the number of errors that end up being made, just simple errors in that process?
Well, yes, actually, that's been a topic. It's not just the translation of the paper records, but even what patients see when they actually get a chance to see their records. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, people are often shocked by what they find when they see the records. It's a challenge that it may be confusing to them. They may find errors. They may not understand the way that it's represented, or they may understand it and feel that it wasn't done the way that it should have been.
Yeah. So when you say people are shocked, is it that they're shocked because they see something that actually turns out is incorrect, or they're shocked because they see something that actually is correct, but they didn't know it, or they didn't fully appreciate that fact?
Yeah, a class of cases here has come from things like the billing codes that were used for the insurance company are exposed to the patient, and the patient is surprised by what the doctor chose to say was the kind of procedure that they had. And so you have a a coming problem of how to deal with education and proper display of the information to patients. It's related to this thing. It was one of the SHARP projects is the cognitive support or usability of the exposure of health information. So it's very valuable to get patients involved in trying to find errors. But on the other hand, if they look at something and they don't understand it, they may think there's an error when there's not, and that could introduce confusion into the system.
Okay. Well, we have a caller here to take. Let's do that. We'll talk with someone in Mahomet on our line one. Hello.
Yes. I don't know why you guys, I mean, there were five countries that were on front line that are already in this system, that already have the computer records for their patients. Five countries. Switzerland and Japan were two of them. And people just come into their doctor, stick a card in like a credit card, and it punches up all their records, and they sit there and have the records with them before they go in to see the doctor. Now, one country sent 12 people to the other four countries they knew of that had national care and found out how they did everything. I don't know why you guys talk and talk and talk and talk and never seem to get anything done. I mean, the fact that we can't get our records, which I had a recent experience, which I have asked five times to have my records of that day. I still haven't gotten them. I mean, this is ludicrous. And why haven't you guys checked out with Europe, who've been on this national health care forever? Why don't you check with them and find out how they do it?
Well, that's a good question. What has been the experience of other countries, and what can we learn by doing that, right, looking at that?
First, I wanted to express sympathy for the caller. This has been, you know, as I go into this subject myself as a researcher, we have great technological capability in the United States, and yet we could do much more than we do, and I find it amazing, as myself as a patient, that it takes so long to get my records from one place to another. It's important, though, to think about some of the challenges here. So first of all, solutions that are used in other countries don't necessarily transplant, without change to the United States. So to give an example of this kind of issue, in Germany, you have a smart card, and you can go and you put your smart card with the doctor, and the doctor accesses your records using the smart card. But in the United States, we have laws that prevent patient identifiers from being made available for the country as a whole, and that we're not allowed to use that solution. And so those solutions that exist in these places do not necessarily transplant here because of American traditions and laws. And so we need solutions that fit America. Okay, that's one point. But another thing is that in some of these countries, the techniques that are used are not necessarily ones that we would choose to use in the United States. So, for example, in some places you can get a concept of integrated record, which means that a doctor can get access to your complete record. And there is a concern possibly that if you go to see, you know, a doctor about your foot, that he shouldn't have access to your mental health notes. And so this challenge of how to make the records available, but how to make only the records available that the patient wants to be made available, that's a hard problem. And so some of these solutions are ones that we wouldn't accept in the United States. It's also true that the United States is bigger than many of these other solutions, and so that the scalability questions would arise. And those solutions have not been easy in those countries. So I very much sympathize with the goal here, but the challenge is not trivial.
Right. Well, I want to thank the caller. We're at a point here we need to take a very short break. We're talking with Carl Gunter. He's professor of computer science at the University of Illinois. We're talking about health information technology and the security of medical records as we move in the direction of having everything stored and moved around electronically and more. We'll talk some more after a short break. This is Focus.
WILL programming is made possible by the Spice Box in Bevere Hall on the U of I campus, offering fine dining on Wednesday and Friday nights beginning February 3rd. Reservations are required. The Spice Box is staffed and managed by students in the Hospitality Management Program. More information is available at 333-6520.
This is Focus, our morning talk show. I'm David Inge. You're glad to have you with us. We are here weekday mornings with 10 topics for you every week. We always encourage you to sample. Maybe there'll be something that will interest you a few times a week, at least we hope. You can go to our website and see the schedule. It's will.illinois.edu. In the second hour today, we'll talk with journalist and writer Julia Shears about her book, A Thousand Lives, The Untold Story of Hope, Deception, and Survival at Jonestown, which does indeed look back to the events that took place in Jonestown. This was in November 1978. She argues here that the people followed Jim Jones to Jonestown because they thought that he would lead them to a better life. And of course, it didn't turn out that way. She's written this book really focusing on the victims of Jonestown. Rather than so much about Jim Jones, but certainly one can't talk about Jonestown without talking about Jim Jones. So more on that in the second hour. Then tomorrow morning in the 10 o'clock hour, we'll be pleased to have here on the show as our guest, Phyllis Wise, Chancellor of the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. She's been on the job here for just a few months, and we'll talk with her about particularly about some issues in higher education, what the value of a college degree is, maybe some of the challenges of administering a major research university. Now, that'll be in the first hour. Then in hour two, we will talk about some of the challenges involved in providing top quality care in nursing home facilities. And we'll have two guests, Christopher Casper, who is the administrator of Country Health Care and Rehabilitation in Gifford, and also Chuck Shute, who's the administrator in the Champaign County Nursing Home. We are here weekday mornings, again, as I say, from 10 to noon. We have 10 different topics every week. You can check the schedule, listen to past programs by going to our website, and that is will.illinois.edu. In this hour of Focus, we're talking with Carl Gunter. He's professor of computer science at the University of Illinois, and we're talking about the move towards electronic health records, something that is we're moving in that direction more and more, and there are real security concerns involved in that. And he and the University of Illinois, part of a major research effort being funded by the federal government to look into various aspects of the move towards electronic health records, and security is one of the big ones. Questions, comments are certainly welcome. 333-9455. That's the Champaign-Urbana number. We have a toll-free line that is good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. And you can also send us an email. That's will-talk@illinois.edu. There's one area that we haven't touched on that I think is really fascinating, and also it's a little scary when you think about the security implications, and that's telemedicine. The fact that now that there are people who are wearing various kinds of medical devices, there are things that collect information on them, and also if you think about pacemakers and insulin pumps, there are things that help keep them alive, but they're vulnerable.
Yeah, so one of the topics that some of the team members on the SHARPS project worked on was to look at the security of implanted medical devices. One of the big benefits going forward is that some of these devices have to be adjusted over time, and so they communicate wirelessly with the outside, and so that this will enable them to be adjusted without surgery. And So the problem is that wireless is a tricky thing to get secure, and so it's possible to demonstrate that some of the medical devices are capable of being hacked, so you might be able to reprogram someone's defibrillator with a laptop. And so that trying to address those concerns is a challenge because, for example, you could imagine the device including security functions like encryption and authentication techniques. Mm-hmm. But then these would draw down the battery life of the device. And so it's very important to think of the safety trait and make the device more complicated as well and possibly inaccessible if the security fails. And so there's a great challenge to figure out how these systems should be secured as we move forward with digital communications with the devices. And so one of the things we've looked at on the project is what would be the acceptable solutions for such a thing. So one of the technologies, just to give an example of some of the technologies we developed, is a kind of necklace or pendant that jams communications with the device. And so you could take this off when the device needs to be communicated with, or you could wear it as a protection measure if you were worried about possible hacking of the device. And So this has the advantage that you don't have to burden the device itself with any particular security measures.
So it's been demonstrated, I think, that such a thing is possible. Has this ever actually been done with malicious intent?
We don't know of any incident where that's occurred. So be assured. But the kind of concern here is that the use of these devices is growing, and that obscurity of a particular avenue of attack is not going to be sufficient to protect people has been a lesson that we've seen many times. And so coming up with credible solutions that balance safety against these other concerns is important. But the risks are not to be ignored. So, for example, we had the poison Tylenol case, where you'd think nobody would ever do such a thing until they do. Mm-hmm. And then also, we don't collect enough records about these devices, perhaps, to know for sure whether this has occurred or not. And so that's another aspect of our research project, is to ask, for example, of FDA, whether we are collecting the kind of information we would require to know whether this is actually something that's a serious concern, or whether we're adequately addressing it.
I'm sure that when these devices were first being developed and implemented, that everybody would have said, well, what a great thing this is. This way we may be able to monitor the person's condition and health, no matter where they are. And if we need to tweak things just a little bit, well, we can do that. What a great thing. Did it even occur to them that somebody might hack into the device maliciously and intentionally want to do something to harm the individual?
Yeah, I guess it's a nature of the security field for the researchers to try to think ahead in these regards and to try to think of what could happen, and then to let it be the case that we put in suitable protections over time so that the devices were not designed with those threats in mind. But the next generation of devices may have some of those protections.
Mm-hmm. Well, again, questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. You can email as well, will-talk@illinois.edu. Well, I guess as somebody who is a layperson and is not really involved in these kind of issues any more than just to have a conversation like this, I would think that particularly if you're interested in protecting data, data that's passed around, that encryption would seem to be a pretty straightforward solution, and that's something we really know how to do. Is there something particularly challenging about this particular kind of data or this way that the data ends up being shared?
Yes, so there's some interesting challenges there. So, for example, we do pretty well with encrypted protection of data in flight. So if I take data and I send it over the internet to another place, then we protect that data with encryption. This is done routinely, largely seamlessly. Average people use this kind of encryption all the time. So if you go to Amazon.com and you buy something, encryption will be used to protect those communications. But in the case of data at rest, that is data in storage, it has been more challenging to get those techniques widely deployed. Mm-hmm. And hence you see these things like the loss of a laptop on a train resulting in a major compromise. This is partly because the data at rest on the laptop has not been protected. So one of our next generation challenges here will be the protection of data in more circumstances, including data at rest. And that has to be reconciled with challenges like you've got a big, busy hospital. People are trying to get their jobs done. If data is being encrypted, is that going to slow things down or cause someone not to get access to something they need when they need it? And we have to be sure that doesn't happen. So the techniques that we use to do encryption of data at rest have to have some of the seamlessness we see for the protection of data in flight. And so this kind of thing is a research challenge that we'll be looking at.
Well, is that particularly complicated?
To encrypt the data we have algorithms for encrypting the data. The problems mainly come in the management of the keys for the data. So the way encryption works is that you do a transformation on the data in such a way as the data can be transformed back to its original form only by someone who has the key. And so if you have a simple circumstance, you can have a simple way of managing the keys. If you have a complex circumstance, then the management of the keys will be more complex.
If you have a lot of people who may need to have access and you don't, and you want it to be timely, don't want them to have to wait around for somebody to come along with the key. If they need it right then, and there are a lot of different people who might need it right then I suppose that makes a lot more complicated.
Yeah, and another example like this is with cloud computing. So you might imagine you give your data to somebody else to hold it for you. But if you encrypted the data, then they wouldn't be able to look at themselves. But you've got then to manage the key. And if you lose that key, you've lost your data. And so you see that you get into these problems of, like, how does that key get managed?
Yeah. And it seems also that it wouldn't be a relatively simple thing to do to remove names so that you would have data. If you didn't have the person's name or other personal information attached to that, so that you would be able to readily identify who that person was, then that data would not be as useful. It might still be useful if you could have a social security number, maybe. Maybe there are other things too, but what's true, you know, do what you can to strip out the personal information, and I suppose you'd have to substitute some kind of identifier so that you could actually get the person together with the data.
Mm-hmm. So this is a very, very important topic covered in the privacy legislation concerning the sharing of medical data, which is in certain circumstances, say if your data is being used for research, then your identity should be hidden. Mm-hmm. But it's rather challenging, actually, to make it so that data can be assured not to be associated back to you. So that there were some early incidents in which health data was released, and things like voter rolls were used in combination with the health data to re-identify the data. And so it became a cautionary tale about how it's very important what you delete and very important what other information is available. And so we're moving into a phase in which people are looking at more sophisticated techniques for doing analysis of these things to determine whether the data has been adequately de-identified. And also, in some cases, what you can do is substitute for de-identification security protective techniques. For example, if only a small group of trusted people is viewing the data, then it may be that less transformational effort is required to prepare the data for their secure use. And so kind of coming up with balances that will protect the data adequately and where we can measure the protection is very important.
Okay. Let's talk with someone else here. I had a caller and they slipped away. If someone would like to call in, we have about 7-8 minutes left in this part of Focus. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We have a toll-free line to go to anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. And also, if you'd like to send a question or comment along by email, you can do that too. That's will-talk@illinois.edu. Well, we've talked about a number of things, and I know that any of these things, I'm sure that there are things you could talk in much greater detail about. Are there some things that we yet have not got to that's important, you think it'd be important for people to hear about?
Maybe one thing is to discuss the audit of health records. So some of the abuses that have occurred were exposed because of laws that require the review of health logs to determine if there have been abuses. Mm-hmm. And so one of our challenges going forward is to balance the incentives for these kinds of reviews. Institutions are probably in some ways reluctant to look at their records to see if an abuse has occurred, given that they may have fines and have to reprimand employees. On the other hand, the trust of the patient is extremely important here. It's a concept that goes back to the Hippocratic Oath that if people don't trust what's done with their data, then they may not seek care when they need it. And so developing techniques to look at how data is being handled and to determine whether it is being handled properly, and then over time to improve the access to the data so that it's accessible by the people who need it when they need it, but is held closely enough that it's not abused, is I think one of our key challenges. And so one of the things we're doing on the project is to look at some of the techniques, for example, that you might imagine that you would see, say, for credit card fraud, so that if an abuse occurs, there are various measures that would make that discovered automatically, and so that you can try to make it the case that you catch more abuse or that you deter abuse. Mm-hmm.
I would think that it would be maybe a little bit easier to put the onus on the people who are, in a sense, on the first line of access to that information. So I'd be thinking about my doctor, the hospital or clinic where I go. But I think that also in places where there have been release of data or problems with data security, it's when you get past that point, when you start getting to third parties, because there are other people, I'm sure, that maybe would want or would need access to that information, particularly if we're talking about third-party payers who are paying for things. Mm-hmm. As you get sort of further out in this net of people who maybe have access, does that get more difficult in trying to make sure that whoever have access, in whoever is authorized to have access and does, takes the appropriate care with the data?
Yeah, so if we think back to this, so imagine that it's only your doctor that has access to the data, then that's going to be a pretty good protection because it's very localized. On the other hand, it can't be only your doctor because they have to reveal information to the insurance company for purposes of payment in some cases, and so that it's more people. And it may be that also some of the nurses need access and so on. And then going back to our earlier call about, you know, getting records from, you know, other places, what if you're seeing a physician at another place? What about that physician's ability to get access to the record, and how are you going to enable that? So this is health information exchange concept. Mm-hmm. And so maybe I'm seeing a doctor at a competing enterprise, and I want to have my records transferred to that party. And so you see it gets complicated as you start to expand the number of people. So that one of the advantages of the electronic records is how quickly they can be moved to different places. But as that is taken advantage of, you expand the pool of people who may be getting access, and then you have to extend your controls to deal with those.
Mm-hmm. Well, we had an earlier caller who was talking about, first of all, her frustration at getting at her own medical records, but also the fact that apparently there are other countries where they've made advancements in this very thing. That is, no matter where you go, either you can have access, instant access, or you can make sure the doctor has access to your health records. And I kind of think that if we're talking about, say, Europe or Japan, or probably almost any place else in the world, we're talking about places that have some kind of national health system, which would tend to facilitate that. At least you could make sure that if you had one system, you did what you could to make sure that the various parts of the system could talk to each other without any sorts of problems.
So an example of an alternative American solution that people have considered, yeah, is to use the personal health records as the ways of exchanging. Mm-hmm. So, for example, if I can go to my doctor and download my health records to my own computer, for example, then if I want to give my health records to someone else, then I can be responsible for uploading them, you know, to the other person. Mm-hmm. And so that the personal health record then becomes the medium of exchange. This has the advantage that it intrinsically includes patient consent, because if you're managing it yourself, then you're deciding whether to transfer it or not. And it doesn't rely on any sort of national health information exchange system. It's robust, you know, in the circumstance you were talking about, like what if you don't have something like the National Health Service, so that if it's a bunch of private companies, how do you deal with that? This could be a way of doing that. Mm-hmm. And so you might imagine other kinds of models for how data gets swapped between parties that might mitigate some of these concerns.
Yeah. Though, of course, then there still is a concern is what is that party to whom you are giving the data going to do with it, and are they going to continue to guard it? Perhaps also does that get into, maybe this is in a sense a different kind of question, but does that get into questions of who does the data belong to? And does are my health records my personal property, or are they the property of the institution that's providing my health care?
Well, there's some complicated legal questions about ownership here. I don't think there's any crisp answer to that question, and it's not really my space to do the legal topics.
Yeah,
but
sure.
It's very important, though, about consent. It's an intrinsic characteristic of the health system that consent has to be an extremely important part of what you do. If people don't trust that their records are used to improve their care and will not be used to harm them, then they will be reluctant to reveal information about themselves that may be important to their timely care. And so that this question of consent has to be compared to the question of ownership to understand how we're going to handle the records.
Well, we're just about at the end of the time, and we have run rather quickly over some fairly complicated territory. Are there particular things that you would like people to come away with as they think about this and as we move more and more in this direction?
One thing I would like to urge as a takeaway is that electronic health records have a great opportunity to improve the quality of care, to foster research that improves health care, to involve people more in their own care, and that these risks make one hesitate, but they can be solved, and that I think we would want to face these problems and to solve them so that we can move ahead with these big advantages. And so I would encourage that people should be cautious but not afraid, that we will provide ways of doing these things.
Yeah. And if people would like to follow this research effort that the university is involved in, is there a way to do that?
Yes, please. The webpage is sharps.org, sharps.org.
All right. Our guest in this hour is Carl Gunter. He's professor of computer science here at the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign. Thanks very much.
Thank you.